This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
I read your book recently, How to Be a Conservative. And I think it's arguably a serious question, is conservatism still alive at all? Because we've seen in the United States, for instance, conservatism has been reduced to a type of free market economy. It's really an economic conception and not really a moral conception. So maybe we could just start.
Well, this is one of the worries that intellectual conservatives like me have. There aren't very many intellectual conservatives, it has to be said. We, on the whole, take the view that ordinary people are conservative, but they just don't articulate it. They're not ever pushed into the place where they've got to find the way of expressing their views rather than just having them and acting on them. But when it comes to politics, in a democracy, politicians have to offer things always.
Right.
And that means that there's a natural tendency for them to put their policies and their suggestions in economic terms. They say, you will be so much better off if you vote for us than if you don't. And gradually, the language of economics takes over every question so that it doesn't look as though there's any real distinction between politics and economics. And I think this has actually damaged the conservative position greatly, because precisely what conservatives are trying to say is that there are things that are jeopardized, things that are at risk, precisely because of our modern way of assigning a cost to everything.
Right.
Of seeing everything in economic terms, the profit and the loss dominating everything, rather than those things that really matter to the spiritual and moral health of the community. So, but you're absolutely right because of this dominance of the economic question, conservatism tends to be seen as simply an apology for a free market economy,
right,
come what may. You know, and so if there's a question about an institution, for instance, what should we do to protect the institution of marriage or primary education or whatever, it gets put into another form. You know, what are the benefits economically,
right,
of the old idea of marriage? You know, who can answer that question?
You know, one of the things that is troubling to me, Berkeley is probably one of the most educated cities on the planet, just in terms of a sheer number of PhDs, people that have been through high levels of academic training. And a lot of our neighbors are PhDs. We have one of the highest concentrations of Nobel Prize winners. What's really interesting is this is also one of the most liberal cultures in the world. And so the question, and I think a lot of people see this, is that conservatism and intellectualism are almost mutually exclusive. And very often the conservative view is a kind of, it's almost, we've got some troglodytes out there that tend to present conservatism in a way that smacks of an almost anti-intellectual approach. And that's very different from, say, a Burkean type of conservatism, which acknowledged gradualism and the importance of change.
Yes, absolutely. I've suffered this all my life, at least ever since I became a conservative, which was in May 1968 in Paris. I hadn't a very clear idea of how to articulate it. All I knew was that when I looked down the street and saw all these rowdy students throwing stones at policemen, I just said to myself, whatever they believe, I believe the opposite.
Right.
And then I didn't know what it was. And then it was a sort of lifetime's work to find out what the opposite is. So, and I somewhat arrogantly came to the conclusion that it's, if you start thinking about politics in an intellectual way, you are likely to be on the left. because that provides a systematic solution, an answer to the questions, puts it all in a system, and also gives you a rather dignified and self-congratulatory place in the system. But once you started thinking, if you think a bit harder and longer about it, you'll move back to what you would have been if you had never thought at all, you know. Right. And that's my view, is what an intellectual conservative is. It's someone who articulates the real reasons for not having reasons.
Say that again.
Someone who articulates the real reasons for not having reasons, but just feeling and doing what's right.
Right. Well, I think, you know, I think it's Yeats. Yeats has a wonderful poem, Easter 1916. Mm. And in there he has the "Come, let us mock at the great that had such burdens on the mind and toiled so hard and late to leave some monument behind." He wrote that when he witnessed some Irish revolutionaries destroy a beautiful house of a very wealthy landed English, Anglo-Irish person. And in a lot of ways, that poem articulates that idea that it's very easy to destroy and tear down. And one of the things that's so tempting for many people, because the world is so troubling to so many people, and so many people suffer in this world, and a lot of what the liberal left tends to rely on is that sense of indignation that a lot of idealistic people feel, because there are things that are deeply wrong with the world. But then when we look historically at how, when these people have gotten into power, whether they're, I mean, people tend to forget that the Nazis were actually, they were quite bohemian in a lot of ways. They had a lot of leftist politics. Certainly their economics was tend to be collectivist, and they were national socialist as opposed to being internationalist. Yeah. But when they get into power, they tend to really, really tear things down and don't give us
I think there's an explanation of this. It's what Hegel calls the labor of the negative.
Right.
The initial instinct on the left is that negative instinct, that things are wrong, and they must be rectified. They can only be rectified, however, by the seizure of power. And so we're going to seize power in order to rectify them. But once you've got the power, the negative is still there in your heart, because it's driven you all along. You know, that's the thing which has inspired you. So you set about destroying things, punishing people. You find classes who are to blame, you know, the Jews, the bourgeoisie, whoever it might be. Yeah. And you don't get out of that negative structure.
Right.
And I feel that's what I felt very strongly in 1968, you know, that, okay, that of course there are things that are wrong in France, but there are also things that are beautiful and right, and you've got to go through this and come back and rescue those things, which is much more important than destroying a few obstacles along the way.
Right. Blake has an interesting, he says, "The hand of vengeance found the bed to which the purple tyrant fled. The iron hand crushed the head and came a tyrant in its stead." And that tends to be a pattern that we see again and again, that when, if you have, for instance, in Iran's a good example of that. I mean, Savak was one of the major reasons for the revolution itself, because the heavy-handedness of the Shah, his secret police, which he probably had no idea. They very often live in these silos and bubbles. They've got, you know, the secret police, the apparatus all comes back. Disappearing, the people that disappear all disappear again. Yeah. So, I mean, this is part of the problem. But again, it's still this fundamental problem. For instance, I mean, one of the things that you talk about in Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands is the idea of power being the way in which everything is articulated. The critique is about power. I mean, Foucault's a good example of that, of somebody who just saw everything in terms of power. But there's definitely truth embodied in that, and I think that's why it's so seductive for so many people.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to deal with the fact that so many people are seduced by this, because they experience, especially marginalized and disenfranchised people.
Yes, that is true. But of course, in the intellectual world, it's extremely corrupting to see things in this Foucauldian way. You know, instead of asking the question, is what Hamza saying true? I ask the question, you know, what power is advancing behind that? You know, you then disappear from the picture,
right.
And also what you've said disappears from
right.
the picture.
Yeah.
I'm no longer engaging with you, I to thou, at all.
Right.
Because without the concept of truth, there is no real engagement between people. All I am seeing is the power that's speaking through you. And that, of course, you can look at the whole of culture in that way, which is essentially what the postmodern curriculum is,
right.
Taking one writer, one philosopher, one musician after another, and just talking about, you know, like Susan McClary on Beethoven. This is fantasies of rape speaking through
right.
this music, you
right.
know. It's extremely boring after a while because it's totally
well,
mechanical.
It's a lens. I mean, one of the things I say about critical theorists, I that if it was a lens, that it might be useful sometimes to just
yeah.
peer through that lens, but it's a corneal transplant.
That's,
you know, and,
yeah,
that's a good metaphor,
yeah.
Yeah, it becomes the only way.
Yes.
And I've seen, one of the things that I've seen with students in my own teaching experience is, you know, I've had critical theorists in my classes, and whenever they raise their hand, I could almost verbatim tell them what they're going to say,
yes.
the response that they're going to give to whatever was said.
Yes.
And
well, then we need to understand why it is so seductive.
That's my point.
Yeah.
It troubles me how seductive it's been. And it also, I grapple in my own self with the amount of genuine injustice in the world
yeah.
that takes place on a daily basis. And I mean, for instance, you know, their attacks on capitalism, to me, the corporate world today is so powerful, and to use a favorite term in that world is hegemonic.
Mm.
You know, this idea where monoculture becomes so imperious, and we've seen so many. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was young, one of the treats in my experience was to go to a bookstore. Bookstores have pretty much been wiped out in the United States because mm. of these corporations. So small bookstores are not able to survive.
Mm.
So now you have you had Borders, but then Borders goes bankrupt.
Mm.
And then now we're left with Barnes and Noble.
Mm.
And so if you go in, who's picking those books? Who's actually choosing what books? Like if you go, for instance, to the teen section, it's almost all about vampires and really weird occultic
mm.
stuff. It's not like, you know, the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew
sure.
mysteries. It's very corrosive ideas.
Yeah. And we've slightly changed the topic now. We're not really talking about this postmodern obsession with power.
Right.
We're talking about change in the structure of life.
Right. And but for me, a lot of, I mean, I'll give you an example. Herbert Marcuse, who I'm not a fan of by any stretch, but when I read some of his works, I was struck by real insights about things that were very troubling about American
yeah.
culture. One-dimensional man,
yeah.
this idea of a consumer and life as consumption,
yes.
and losing meaning. I mean, his solutions is a whole other problem. But and this is something I think that's very seductive, is that the critical aspect of Marxism and neo-Marxism has always been, it's always had a resonance in a lot of people. There's something very, very powerful about it. When you get to solutions and how we deal with these things, we're in another realm. But if conservatives don't really address the real serious critiques
yeah.
That are there
yeah.
about the status quo.
Yeah, I think you're right. They have. Perhaps neglected those critiques, but you know, as I was saying earlier, the purely negative approach to the status quo is simply going to perpetuate this negativity, and has done. If you're not the typical conservative, in my reading of events, is someone who looks around himself and he finds things that he loves, you know, and he thinks, well, those things are threatened, they're vulnerable, right. I've got to protect them. And it's not often that you find on the left somebody who looks around and finds things that he loves. It's always something that's gone wrong, something that is even hateful, and you've got to mobilize against it. If you've lost any sense that actually the world is lovable and that there are things therefore to be rescued in it, you have actually lost the sense of why there is such a thing as a community in the first place. And that, I think, is one of the things that I felt very strongly throughout my life, that there really are wonderful things that we've inherited. All Americans, however, whatever position in society they are still heirs to something rather remarkable. You know, a rule of law which goes on perpetuating itself from generation to generation. If only people knew how rare that was, they would see that they've got to fight to preserve it. You know, and the same with so many other institutions that we inherited.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think one of the most interesting things, and Gwyn, we were talking about Gwyn earlier, the grammarian. One of the things that Gwyn points out, and it really struck me in his little book on grammar that made quite a splash, I think, in the UK. One of the things that he points out is that language, our English language, has not changed a great deal. I mean, the conservation of the language. Because there's a lot of people that the descriptivist will just say that language is whatever people use. Yeah. But there is a reason to hold on and to preserve language, because if we allow language to dissipate into private languages, we lose the ability to communicate as a culture or a civilization.
That is all true, but also equally true is the fact that language as we inherit it is not the product of a single person. It's the evolved gift of generations, and it contained in every word there is a kind of history of the human condition. We're actually inheriting wisdom with language. These words make distinctions that we couldn't have ever made ourselves without their aid. But we are entering a world where grammar is not given the importance that it deserves.
One of the things, for me, I mean, conserving language is extremely important, and it was an obsession of Muslims. The idea, the Quran, in essence, almost froze the Arabic language in a period. So the ideal of Arabic will always be the Quran, and in some ways the King James Bible did that to English to a certain degree.
Yes, it did. But interestingly, of course, the King James Bible is unashamedly a translation, and the Quran most Muslims don't accept that it can be exactly translated,
right.
Because it has a perfection of its own. Of course, it was recited. I mean, you know more about this than me. It was recited long before it was written down.
Right.
And then it had achieved a kind of statuesque quality that that our Bible has never managed. But, grammar, the grammar of the King James Bible is often quite unorthodox.
Sure.
It's a very strange book, and we now it is the book that made our 17th and 18th century literature. There's no doubt about that.
Arguably, it's the book also that made some of the greatest orators in our civilization.
Yes.
I mean, Lincoln's reliance and dependence on the King James Bible was immense.
But hardly any church now uses it.
Right.
My church, the Anglican Church, does use it. But only in certain little places and in villages or in high ceremonial occasions. I mean, for the most part, it's the New English Bible that has replaced it.
There, you went to grammar schools, and they've been largely, the attack on grammar schools has been amazing because it's been seen as an elitist enterprise.
Yeah.
And one of the things that struck me, I read a book by David Mulroy called The War Against Grammar.
Yeah.
It was quite an eye-opening book for me, because one of the things that in teaching our students Arabic, it's very difficult because many of them have very little English grammar.
Yeah.
And traditionally, grammar grammatical languages. I mean, all languages are grammatical, but by that I mean a language that is almost impossible to understand without knowledge of grammar, like Arabic, because it's inflected and because it the verbs are conjugated. And so if you don't have some understanding of that, it becomes very difficult. But David Mulroy makes this argument that in the 1960s, early 60s in the U.S., there was actually a movement to stop teaching grammar, and they saw it as very abusive to children. Right. And but what's interesting, he has something that I've replicated in several classes. I on average, I'll take 50 students. I give them the opening sentence to the Declaration of Independence: when in the course of human events it becomes necessary, to the end of that sentence. It's a sentence that has several subordinate clauses, and all I ask the students is, identify the main point of this sentence. Now, these are college students. On average, out of 50 students, I'll get two or three that actually can identify the main clause. And so there's a type of higher illiteracy that the fact that grammar has been removed. And I think a restoration of language is the only thing. For me, the salvation of a civilization has to be predicated on the resurrection of the corruption of its language.
Well, I think you've actually touched on what the real essence of conservatism is there. You know, that there are things that the conservation of which is actually fundamental to understanding the world as it is.
Right.
And if you lose those things, like the rules of grammar, the habits of good speech, or good manners, the sense of what a legal solution, as opposed to a mere bullying solution to a conflict might be, all those things we are, used to be taught to us as part of becoming an adult. If you lose those things, you're at sea in the world. And I think that's one of the things that that most worries me about modern education. You refer to this movement in our schools to abolish grammar as elitist. It's absolutely true that grammar is elitist because it makes a distinction between the people who know it and the people who don't.
Right.
And that's the kind of distinction that we all need if we're to survive,
right,
not only as a civilization, but as individuals too. Right. So this is where the real arguments for conservatism, in my view, should be based, not in the economic sphere at all, but in these fundamental cultural inheritances.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think it's very one of the things that really troubles me. We had recently a professor, I think, down in Southern California at a major university, who was considered racist because he was demanding that the students use proper grammar. And so the minority students objected to that because they felt that it was
discriminatory.
It was discriminatory. Mm. And one of the things about in our culture, and I think the poor white people in this culture are also disenfranchised from a type of normative or conventional language. And I think it's very disempowering to do that.
Yes, of course. When I was at school, grammar school, I came from a poor background.
Right.
You know, and we were our teachers, as their first instinct when they found that you were in some way handicapped by the language that you'd learned from your parents, was to take you in hand, give you the advantage which your family had not, so that you could catch up with the others.
Right.
And I think that's that idea of teaching, that you're actually lifting people up so as to be able to receive their inheritance. That idea has gone to a great extent.
Yeah.
It's much more now that the teacher comes down to the level of the student.
Exactly. And this Pygmalion's a good example of that, because Shaw, in Shaw's Pygmalion, and obviously there's a lot of irony and sarcasm in that, but the idea of the flower girl who speaks non-standard English, wanting to speak like a lady, to speak proper, as a way of upward mobility.
Yes.
And one of the things that Toynbee points out is that a civilization on its way out inverts that. So there's a vulgarization of the patrician class, where they begin to speak
in profanities.
In profanities.
Yes.
And become...
Yeah, unfortunately that is so, yeah. But yeah, I think we mustn't be too pessimistic about everything.
Okay.
But, I mean, your role, you are someone who's found in Islam something which gives him the foundation that he needs right. in order to confront this gradual degeneration of things all around. And I respect that. If one can find that foundation, one can then start building again to recapture those things which are jeopardized by the laxness of our of modern society. And I think you've got to be optimistic about that. You've got to think that you can recapture these things. Otherwise, you know, what are you doing as a teacher? You know, that's
yeah. It depends on what day it is.
Oh, really? Okay, right. So yeah,
the Arabs have a famous story about a king who had a positive day and a negative day. Yom Wafa. So, I mean, some days I look out there and it's so overwhelming that what's happened. We're old enough. You're a little ahead of me, but we're both old enough to know how different the world that we grew up in is today, and it's quite devastating in a lot of ways. My mother, who was 96 when she passed, I said to her, she when she was born, there was an Ottoman caliph in 1921,
right.
and I asked her, and she was extremely liberal, and I was raised with a lot of liberal sensibilities. My father was very conservative, but so I got both sides, and it was very interesting to see those two views and how powerful each one is in its own way. But when I asked her once, just what do you think is the worst thing about what's happening? She said manners.
Yes.
Just the loss of manners. Yeah. And one of the, there's a French, I can't remember his name, but there was a French ethicist who wrote a book on virtues about 15 years ago.
Was that, Comte?
Yeah, Comte.
Something. Comte.
It was called The Book of Virtues.
That's right.
And the first virtue he had in there was courtesy.
Yes.
And one of the foundational virtues of the Islamic civilization is adab.
Yeah.
And which means comportment, it means decorum, it means courtesy, but
does
it also
mean
means
literature. Yeah,
exactly. So the adib is somebody who has absorbed the humanities.
Yes. The habits of proper dialogue, and I mean that is very interesting. Of course, you living here in Berkeley, You only have to look out of the window to see how far things can decline. You know, I look out of my window onto the English countryside,
right.
And mostly horses whose manners remain constant from generation to generation.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But Berkeley is famous for being the pioneer in degeneracy, whatever form. And maybe one should, the very fact that you can plant your institution here and still get, not only recruit people, but also create this kind of atmosphere of peace and goodwill in the middle of all this suggests that, that Berkeley-style degeneracy is perhaps not more than skin deep in the end.
Well, can I say something in defense of Berkeley?
Yeah.
Of being here? I found the people here are they're very welcoming people and this is where I really try to avoid, and maybe it's my mother and my father's influence on me of just seeing both sides. I really try to avoid Manichaean type of worldviews, and I think this Dionysian impulse that's clearly there in us as a species, and the Apollonian, this idea of order as opposed to this kind of chaotic, ecstatic type of being. And I think one of the things in our tradition, in the Islamic tradition, was very interesting to me, is they have this concept of what they call the Mujdub Salik, who's the goal in the spiritual tradition of Islam is to be inwardly in a state of ecstasy, but outwardly in a state of sobriety. And so there's this very interesting Dionysian Apollonian balance
that's
actually taking place. And I think one of the things that happens in a culture that loses the ability to experience internal ecstasy,
comes from the soul.
I mean, I'll give you an example. I've been reading a book called Videocracy, which is about viral videos mm-hmm. online. And there was a video that went viral by this guy named Bear Vasquez. And it was him seeing a double rainbow outside of his house. And he's just in a state of just awe. And then he starts crying. He breaks down and just starts crying. And he's asking, what does this mean? And there's something very powerful about that is such an appropriate response to a double rainbow. And I think whatever happened, it resonated in a lot of people, what he was seeing. And I think our culture no longer gives people vehicles for the experience of joy.
Now, that's a really important point. Pleasure has driven out joy.
Exactly,
Because joy is essentially something which comes from your deep social nature, from your need for others and your need to give to others.
Yes.
And I think that I've often, you know, the problem is we're agreeing about too much, but I see this in the change in patterns of dancing. The dancing that I love, like Scottish country dancing formation dancing.
Yeah. So I had to do Greek dancing as a child.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, they are full of joy because they are ways of relating to others, forgetting about your appetites, just being with. Whereas modern, head bash, smashing.
It's solipsistic.
It's solipsistic and narcissistic. Yeah. And narcissism is joyless because it concentrates only on what can be received and not what can be given.
Well, the other thing what's fascinating too about that, because I thought about dibke with Lebanese dancing, Syrian dancing, which is very similar to Greek dancing.
That's right.
And one of the things about that type of dancing is that there's a formalism that's very rigid, but within that formalism, once you master it, you're allowed to improvise and do certain things. There's a freedom that comes. And there was something that my father used to always say about the liberal arts is that the purpose was this immense discipline that set you free.
Yeah.
That through that structure and discipline, you actually become free.
That's...
And I think this conflation of freedom with licentiousness and freedom with do what thou wilt, the kind of the thalema, you know, the Abbey of Thalema, this idea that... that we can just simply do what we want, and that's how we're going to find happiness.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Now, there's a false idea of freedom which took over the world in the 60s, in a way, with the baby boomers. We don't know quite why, but this idea that freedom means the absence of control.
Yeah. Plato would say it was a change, the absence of control rather than
an order in the soul.
Right.
You know, my ideal of freedom is something like Bach's Art of Fugue, in which every note is necessary, but every note is totally free. You know, that idea that there is an order which reveals itself through free gestures. Mm. And that's really what you're saying about those old Mediterranean styles of dancing.
Yes. I think it's also, rhetoric was like that. I mean, Shakespeare, Miriam Joseph wrote a dissertation, Shakespeare and the Arts of Language, where she proved that he had mastered all of these rhetorical treatises of his time, and knew over 200 tropes and schemes. It's amazing. And often borrowing from the very text that he had mastered. So the artifice, which used to be a kind of positive term in the past, this idea of craft, of real craftsmanship. And I think the two areas where we still see it in our culture to a certain degree, I mean, popular music is very troubling in a lot of ways, but I think you still see it in music and sports, athletics.
Yeah. You know, see it in jazz improvisation, of course.
Yes.
Which doesn't make sense at all until you've mastered the chord sequence.
Right.
And can hear the hidden melody in the improvisation.
Yes. So in sports, people go to these stadiums or they watch on television. What they're waiting for is that magical moment, you know, the triple play in baseball.
Yeah.
I don't know what they have the equivalent in cricket is.
I think hitting something for six or something. I don't know.
Right, but there's a moment where and people look at each other as if they've just witnessed a miracle.
Yes,
something. But that can only happen because of an immense discipline that occurred, and we've lost that. We've lost that in so many other areas of being human.
But again, we can get it back, yeah. And we have got to be optimistic about this.
Well, for us, in our tradition, it's considered an obligation to be hopeful.
Yes, of course, likewise for Christians, faith, hope, and charity are the three fundamental virtues. Meaning by charity.
Love.
A certain kind of love, yes. But that's another problem. That idea of love has become so corrupted.
Well, it's, it's the Greeks had that nice distinction.
Yeah, between agape and eros and all the other sorts of love, too.
Arabs do that as well.
Yeah.
Arabs have 10 different types of love.
Oh, right.
The highest being khalla.
Right.
The lowest being ishq, which is the
Desire.
Well, actually, it's, desire. Hmm. Yeah, eros.
Yeah. But hib is still quite a good thing.
It's a beautiful thing, yeah. Mm. And it's related, it's cognate of another word, which is seed.
Mm.
That love is something that is nurtured and
right.
grows. Because hab is seed, and hub is love.
Right.
Yeah.
There you are.
You know, one of the things that that the traditional world, C.S. Lewis talks about this, but one of the things that the traditional world really understood was the Wheel of Fortune, which has really been removed from our culture. This idea that there is this cycle.
Yes.
And you're talking about optimism. When you're down at 6 o'clock, which in the wheel was traditionally the corresponding emotion was despair.
Yeah.
Right? So 9 o'clock was hope, right? 12 o'clock joy, and then 3 o'clock was fear.
Yeah.
But that, you know, Boethius in that the Consolation of Philosophy, that second chapter where he talks about this, you know, this wheel of fortune, and our culture is, you know, it doesn't allow for that recognition.
No, because it doesn't. It doesn't allow for the idea that ultimately we must be reconciled to things, rather because there's always going to be someone else's fault if you're in trouble, and it's always going to be the case that someone's going to step in and give you what you need.
Right. I mean, what brought my attention to that was hub, you know, hub.
Yes.
Because in the Islamic tradition, the way to get out of the wheel was to get into the hub.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, to get out of the.
Yeah. So you're not spinning.
Not spinning anymore. Mm. That things around you can happen.
Yes. The still point of the turning world, as T.S. Eliot says. Yeah.
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 Well, you know, one of the things in trying to revive a civilization, Islam. Toynbee talks about a civilization with its back up against the wall, and he says that there's different responses to that. One of them is what he called the Herodian response, and I think you see that in places like Malaysia and other Muslim cultures, where Morocco is a good example of that, of just recognizing we've lost sovereignty, we have to live in the world, and let's do our best. But then he says there's the zealots who refuse to accept. It's kind of the Masada complex, where instead of trying to grapple with what's happening, they end up just reacting against it and fighting it even to the death. So it becomes a kind of nihilistic response to a crisis of civilization. But then he talks about the Pharisees, the kind of Benedict option, which is to try to preserve. Getting back to conservation, to try to preserve the best of a civilization. And I think one of the things that I'm trying to do and that we're trying to do here at Zaytuna, we have an extraordinary civilizational tradition in both the West and in the Muslim world. And Muslims living in the West are very often unaware of how powerful Western civilization and the ideas that many of them, I mean, in a lot of ways, the modern world to me is a Christian heresy, because many of these extraordinary ideas, the rights of man, the idea that everybody should be free, you know.
These are byproducts of the Christian way of life.
And Locke and Hume, all these people, they were informed by Christianity. So their ideas didn't simply come out of some kind of philosophical vacuum.
Right.
That these were people that were in societies that were deeply dyed in the wool Christian societies.
But yeah, one of the questions that people, we in Europe in particular, have is what happened to Islamic civilization in the Middle East? You know, those of us who study these things do recognize that there was an incredible inheritance of philosophy, law, literature, and then suddenly nothing.
Yeah.
And now you go to the Middle East, there, of course you meet the educated people. They're very, very few and far between.
Yeah.
And and nobody seems to be concerned to teach this. Mm-hmm. And when you get the radical movements like ISIS, it's not the knowledge and beauty of Islam that appeals to them, but rather the ease with which it can justify their murderous rage.
Sure.
You know, and that's something which I feel not enough is said about this, and in particular we need Muslims to speak out about this and say, look, you guys, Islam is not about justifying these primitive emotions of not belonging that you have. It's about something else. It's about an inheritance. I don't know whether you feel the same about that.
Well, I mean, I would say, first of all, one of the things that stable Muslim societies, despite the political problems, despotism is certainly a problem in many parts of the Muslim world. But stable Muslim societies, what struck me, and I lived in several Muslim countries for many years. I was over 10 years in the Muslim world. What struck me actually was just the incredible goodness of so many Muslims.
Right.
I mean, I found the generosity, the hospitality, the incredible a theocentric worldview that informs them, and the ability to withstand incredible suffering. Mm. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was in West Africa, I was trained as a nurse. So when I lived in West Africa, I went with a physician and we would see patients. And one of the things that was so amazing was people would tell their symptoms, but they would always preface it by saying, I'm not complaining.
Mm.
I'm just, you asked me what I'm feeling. So I just want you to know I'm not complaining.
Mm.
And then they would just say, Alhamdulillah, you know, praise be to God. Mm. And because they really were afraid of complaining.
Mm.
Just the gratitude was so powerfully embedded in a lot of these traditional cultures. I literally saw Moroccan men when I first went to Morocco in 1977 on more than one occasion. If they saw bread, they would pick it up and put it on their forehead and then put it in a high place.
Mm.
You know, and Ezra Pound has a wonderful statement. He says that I don't know what power exploded in the 7th century of Arabia that spread to the libraries of Cordoba, but I got a glimpse of it in the way the Moor walked in 1913 in Tangier. To me, I love so much about the Muslim world, and there's so many things that I see in the Muslim world that when I come back to the West, I really get a bit depressed.
Yeah, well, you're talking about piety in its widest sense, aren't you?
Exactly.
That sense that your gestures, your words, your way of being towards others all fit into a kind of a pattern, which is not just you, but also is informed by courtesy as well as obedience.
I mean, I just saw so many examples of that.
Yeah.
I'll give you just one. We were on a trip in the Sahara, and our car got stuck, and we had to seek refuge in a Bedouin. There was some Bedouin staying there, and it was an incredibly windy night, They literally sacrificed a lamb for us. They cooked it. They fed us, and these were incredibly poor people. Mm. And then we went to sleep, and because there was so much wind, the man was holding up the central pillar of the tent so that it didn't collapse. When we woke up about 4 hours later, he was still there holding it.
Oh,
and
nice.
And I was with an Englishman who just said to me, "Did he stay up the whole night?" And I said, "Yeah, he did."
Mm.
And I just saw so many examples of that.
That, of course, is that Bedouin hospitality, the sense that the stranger is more important than you, that is something which is not only Islam, it's part of the desert way of life, isn't it?
No, I agree. And I think many traditional, I would argue that if you go to Mexican villages, you will find very similar. Yeah. And it's something about traditional cultures that breeds that. But I think Islam definitely inculcates that in its followers when it's practiced properly. Now, as to your question, what happened? I think the same could be asked about the West because, I mean, if I look at what's happened to family, if I look at the fact that pornography is the main entertainment medium now in the West, I mean, it's quite incredible the industry of which you and I are very familiar with just from that what we happened to be part of at the Witherspoon. Yeah. But I think two things happened that are tragic in the Islamic tradition. One is somebody like Al-Farabi, who was ignored, or Averroes is another example of that the influence of a kind of Eastern despotism, which was actually very alien to the Arabs. The Arabs were far more democratic. So the Prophet ﷺ, I mean, there's a chapter in the Quran called Shura, chapter 42, which is mutual consultation.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so the idea of having a type of parliamentary and government would have been very natural to the Arabs, because that's the way they tended to. It was more like an Athenian democracy in a lot of ways. In fact, when I took my teacher, Sheikh Abdullah bin Beya, to the Parliament in England, he was very struck by the House of Lords. He really liked the idea of having what in the Arabic tradition are called Ahl al-Halli wal-Aqad, the people that can unravel and put back together again. Mm-mm. And these are like notables in a culture that have a lot of life experience. And so they have a wisdom that they can help guide a society. He was very struck by that. Mm-hmm. But he and this is something you bring up. I mean, he felt that a parliamentarian government would be perfectly consonant with an Islamic way of ruling, that there isn't really any fixed type of Islamic rule. And I think what happened in the Muslim world is despotism, a kind of an Eastern despotism, became a model. And I think it really stifled a lot of the incredible intellectual and spiritual growth that occurred in the early part of Islam.
Well, it was also the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, wasn't it?
That was a huge,
which led to the new kind of kind of criminal apparatus that advanced through the Ba'ath Party and things like that to take over this ripe fruit. And but yes, I mean, politically, obviously, things went terribly wrong. But what has always concerned me is the cultural aspect. Where is that? You know, what has happened to the great universities, and where do we find proper articulate discussions in literary form and all the things that actually and the Islamic civilization really needs.
Right. I mean, that's what we're trying to do here.
Yes, of course.
I mean, we I think there are people within the Muslim culture. I mean, I have friends in Turkey that are trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And there are attempts. But again, if you look at the Muslim world has been hard hit for several hundred years. I mean, there's been a continue. There's an argument now amongst certain Orientalist tradition about that there wasn't a kind of stagnation or ossification, which I think, to me, is absurd. I mean, I can clearly see the incredible interest in science and technology in early Islam was amazing. And I mean, if there was a Nobel Prize 1,000 years ago, it's been said, every name on the list would have been Muslim. So that's something that I think we as a religious tradition and a ummah that we have to think deeply about. And I think it's very important. I mean, we called our journal Renovatio, or Tajdid in Arabic, which is to make new again, to renovate. The idea, and this is, I think, a very conservative idea, the idea that the house is there, and instead of tearing it down and rebuilding a house, if it's a beautiful house with a solid foundation, we need to renovate it to make it new again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the same task that we have in the West, But of course, we have the freedom to do it. That's the important thing that many people worry about the Muslim world. Do people have the freedom to do what you want to do?
Well, I think you're certainly doing your role in promoting the idea of conserving the best of the past. My last question to you, one of the things that troubles me most about a lot of attacks on conservatism is the idea that the best of progressivism, like the elimination of slavery, the idea of getting rid of racism, as you know, this idea of somehow that there can be ethnic superiority of one people over another. I believe that there are civilizational aspects that are certainly, I think I would much rather have freedom than despotism. And this idea that we can relativize these type things is wrong. But the idea that one group of people is better than another group is a very odious idea, I think, to anybody that has thought deeply about that problem. But this idea that conservatism is conserving the worst of the past as opposed to the best, and is not also acknowledging the idea that there are things that have to change.
Yeah.
And then it becomes, what are the strategies to bring about that change that are going to...
Yeah, I would say, as I understand it, that of course human beings are imperfect. That's the whole reason why they need institutions, in order to mediate between them and overcome conflict without violence. You know, but we have inherited those sort of institutions that enable us to rectify problems and make things better. We're never going to make them perfect, but that's why what we should be conserving are those procedures, the things that enable us to relate to each other in a humane and civilized way. Right. And that for me is what it's all about.
All right. Well, on that note, I want to thank you just for coming out and gracing us with your intelligence and you've been supporting our work with the journal, the Renovatio. I hope some of the people that enjoy reading yours will also benefit from our journal.
I'm sure they will.
Yeah, maybe you could give a little plug.
Yeah, I will, definitely. Yeah. I think Zaytuna is one of the points of hope in the world in which we live now.
Well, thank you. All right, well, God bless you and thank you.
And you too.
Look forward to a continued discussion.